Thank you very much. Appreciate it. It's great to be back, and I'm glad to see some familiar faces and some new faces here. My talk last week was from my book, The Global Right Wing, which, as I mentioned last week, looked at the Christian right and religious right globally, also looked at the National Rifle Association and its activities promoting gun rights worldwide. And I think there was a question about that last week as well. But last week's talk focused primarily on the way in which the Christian right was working at the United Nations to try to promote its own views of the natural or traditional family, and also simultaneously to fight against the human rights groups and particularly gay rights groups that have been very active at the United Nations for the last 20 years trying to promote LGBT rights. Christian right has also been very much active at the United Nations trying to oppose reproductive rights, while those on the left have been trying to promote it. And one of the main points of my talk last week was that these two different worldviews have been clashing at the United Nations, not only on those policy issues, whether we should have abortion rights, whether LGBT rights should be recognized by the UN, but about every aspect of the conflict that would end up with a policy of abortion or not, bans on abortion. Everything from participation at the UN, they fought over who could actually be part of the UN process, both sides trying to exclude the other. They fought over every aspect of the claims that they were making, including science, religion, and the effects of the policies that the two sides wanted. For instance, I'm kind of epitomizing it here by showing the fight over same-sex marriage, which some on the left see as a basic human right now, and others on the Christian right see as not only not a right, but also an extreme problem for the world, something that could lead to what they call demographic winter. And the two sides also fight over the process by which the UN might develop new rights, with one side trying to promote new international law through new types of norms that are developed at lower levels of the UN, and the other side trying to say, no, that's totally illegitimate. Well, beyond their fighting at the United Nations, which I have found very interesting, and I did go and observe this at the UN, they also have the same kinds of conflicts taking place around the world. And in some ways, it's rooted in the United States. The American Christian right has been at the culture wars for many decades. But in other ways, what they do is find groups in many a country around the world who are trying to, on their own, defend what they call the traditional or natural family. And then these American groups go overseas to help them in their battles. And what I'm going to focus on today is their legal battles, but it also involves all manner of other types of political interactions. And often they then bring back the conflict that takes place maybe in Uganda, as I show on the front cover of my book, or in various countries in Europe. I'm going to talk about Sweden and Romania in this talk. They bring them back to the United States in very interesting ways and try to demonstrate to their constituencies that these battles fought overseas are very relevant here in the United States as well. So what I'm going to do today is focus on the way in which American activists work overseas. Although the book did look at Uganda and the very nasty fight there over a law that actually gave required the death penalty for homosexual activities, I'm going to actually focus on these two European countries, Sweden and Romania. Romania being one of the more conservative countries in Europe, especially on questions of sexuality, a country dominated by the Romanian Orthodox Church. And on the other hand, I'm going to look at Sweden, which is one of the most advanced countries in Europe with regard to LGBT rights, with it being one of the first countries in Europe in which same-sex marriage was recognized. But before I get to Sweden and Romania, a key background point, especially when we're talking about how American activists went overseas to try to help these people in these other countries, is to understand what the U.S. Supreme Court has said about foreign law and its applicability here in the United States. Because this is a main reason why Christian conservative lawyers, in particular, have gone to these other countries. So, historically, the Supreme Court has not been particularly friendly to foreign law being part of our jurisprudence. We tend to be very much interested in our own sovereign and constitutional rights and laws. But beginning in the early 2000s, a series of Supreme Court cases in a relatively liberal court had passages in the decisions basically saying that foreign law could be looked at in the United States, not as precedent exactly, but as a basis on which we might ultimately change our laws. So two cases in particular, Roper v. Simmons and Lawrence v. Texas, involved decisions first in the Lawrence case on homosexual activity, Roper v. Simmons, a case that had to do with juvenile executions. Both of those cases were decided by the relatively liberal side of the court, and both of them included some statements that foreign law could be referenced or looked at by the Supreme Court. And they also included actual citations to foreign law. The cases which did allow homosexual or did end a Texas law on sodomy, banning sodomy, and the other one which allowed juvenile executions, both of them, as I said, were decided sort of on the progressive side. They ended that anti-sodomy law and they banned the juvenile executions. But what that did beyond just the court was it spurred progressive activists to look more and more to foreign law as a basis for making arguments in favor of a variety of different rights here in the United States. In particular, and relevant to this course, talk, it was looking at LGBT rights, especially in Europe and especially countries like Sweden and Holland, where LGBT rights were highly developed, much more so than in the US in the early 2000s. So places like Columbia Law School with their law clinics that promoted human rights and LGBT rights began to talk about the idea of bringing human rights or foreign law back to the United States to try to promote our own quest for higher degrees of LGBT rights and same-sex marriage as a human right, ultimately. However, on the court itself and in Christian conservative circles around the country, there was real opposition to any aspect of foreign law being brought into the United States as a basis for us changing our law. Part of it is just that, you know, they saw countries like Sweden and Holland and many others developing rights in a way that they disagreed with. And part of it, I think, was just a principled stand that, you know, the United States, as a sovereign constitutional democracy, should not look overseas to other laws. So Samuel Alito, the Supreme Court Justice, had a extremely nasty negative reaction to the decisions in Roper v. Simmons and Lawrence v. Texas attacking any use of foreign law in the United States. And many Christian conservatives basically agreed with that. But seeing that foreign law was permitted by the majority, and seeing foreign law as well being mentioned in the UN in the cases I talked about last time, other conservatives said, on one hand, no, foreign law shouldn't be allowed in, but if it's allowed in, then we, as Christian conservatives, have to try to do something about that foreign law, either to fight or change the law in other countries, which we'll see in the case of Sweden in just a moment, or to actually try to implant what they considered good laws overseas. Good laws meaning those based on the U.S. practice, at least at that point, we had a Defense of Marriage Act in place at that point in many states in the United States. And so, as we'll see, in Romania, Christian conservatives basically exported American-style Defense of Marriage Acts to that country, and then would argue that those laws proved that foreign law really supports their side in the fight over same-sex marriage back here in the U.S. I know that's a little complicated as an intro here, but you'll see how this plays out in just a second in each of these cases. So first, let's look at how the Christian right has sought to fight what they consider bad law overseas. And here I'm going to look, as I said, at Sweden, which is a country in Europe that has some of the most advanced laws on LGBT rights, a country that was one of the first to have same-sex marriage, and a country which in 2002 put into place an amendment to their existing hate speech law that added public disrespect for a group defined by sexual orientation to their existing hate speech law, which would potentially land someone in jail for up to 2 years, or up to 4 years, ultimately, if they engaged in hate speech on initially racial and national origin lines, religious lines, but after this amendment, on anyone who would critique another group through hate speech based on sexual orientation. Well, Swedish gay rights groups, including this one, RFSL, which is affiliated with the International Lesbian and Gay Association, were ecstatic about this. They thought this was absolutely the way to go, end hate speech, promote LGBT rights, and they even went so far as to raise the question of, you know, what if a pastor quoted from the Bible or was up at having a sermon in which he said things disrespectful of gays. And they said, well, there should be no pass for pastors. They too should, in that case, end up going to jail. The next year, this man here, Åke Greena, although I'm going to call him Åke Green because it's a lot easier, Åke Greena, who is a Pentecostal pastor in a small rural constituency in a place called Borgholm, Sweden, gave a rip-roaring anti-gay speech from the pulpit on a Sunday, July 23rd, including these lines here. There was lots of other very unpleasant language about homosexuality, some of it directly from the Bible. In any event, it's unclear whether he was trying to test the law or whether he was simply trying to say what he felt from his heart. But the sermon was got out, and the public prosecutor in that part of Sweden ended up indicting him. He was brought to trial, and he was sentenced to 1 month in jail for these statements from the pulpit, for violating this hate speech law. The gay rights groups in Sweden were very happy about this. In fact, as you see here, the quote from RFSL, freedom of religion should never imply agitation against persons. And international gay rights groups like the ILGA were also very happy about this prosecution. They felt that hate speech should, in fact, end up with someone spending some time in jail, and that would ultimately reduce hate speech. Now, the Christian right has its sort of ears out about these kinds of issues around the world, and within just a matter of weeks after the conviction, because there was some media attention in Sweden, it got international, a major Christian right law firm known as the Alliance Defense Fund, based in Scottsdale, Arizona, decided we have to come to the defense of Åke Greena. Ake Green. Because this is a conviction that is totally wrong on free speech bases, and not only that, would make it hard for us to promote our anti-gay agenda worldwide. So they swooped in from Scottsdale, Deus ex Scottsdale, if you will. This man on the right, Benjamin Bull, their chief counsel, went to Sweden and spent months there. I interviewed him by phone. He's actually a very interesting and nice guy on the phone, and I actually learned a great deal from him. He's also a very talented lawyer. The Alliance Defense Fund was the law firm that was involved in the Obergefell decision. He was defending, he was opposing same-sex marriage in that decision, which he ultimately lost. He ultimately lost at the Supreme Court, but it just shows his presence in that case shows, you know, that he is one of the top lawyers in this area of litigation in the country. And he and his relatively large law firm based in Scottsdale ended up spending a lot of time in Sweden trying to keep Åke Green out of jail. How did they do it? Well, for one thing, just like I mentioned last time, they built a network of other Christian right legal defense organizations from the US and UK and other countries around the world to help out in his defense, in his appeal, that is, including the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, Advocates International, and a number from the UK, the Jubilee Campaign, Family Research Council, that's another US Christian right group. All of them came together for the appeal that Åke Green, with the help of Alliance Defense Fund, began to mount in Sweden. And one of the more interesting things I found in this research was that not only did they come and just give legal advice, they also actually introduced new types of legal strategies into Swedish litigation. Most importantly, amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, in which groups like the ones you just saw actually submitted legal documents to the Swedish Appeals Court and then the Swedish Supreme Court, something which had never been done previously in Sweden. So these groups are not only coming overseas and bringing their own ideologies, they're bringing new practices to countries. And the Swedish courts actually decided we're going to allow this. And that became a new precedent for fighting this kind of litigation in Sweden. And their basis for this was stated in this amicus, part of their amicus briefs. Law now operates in a global village. And when Sweden violates international guarantees, other nations won't hesitate to do the same. I think they were mostly thinking about the United States, but they were thinking globally as well. So as part of their overall global strategy, they believed we have to fight this particular case because it's kind of the cutting edge of hate speech on sexual orientation grounds anywhere in the world. They were very active not only in filing briefs and arguing in the Supreme Court of Sweden, but also in some of the media tactics that they had pioneered in other parts of the world as well. And Green, at least in Sweden and among Christian conservatives worldwide, became a cause celeb because he was promoted not only on Swedish national television, but also on a whole range of Christian media that most of us probably wouldn't look at, but which has a really big impact in Christian conservative groups worldwide. Groups like organizations like LifeSite News, which I think I mentioned last week. So, as the Christian right got more and more involved from overseas into this seemingly small-scale Swedish fight, the gay rights groups around the world, as well as in Sweden, became more and more active as well in trying to maintain the conviction of Green and have him actually serve his time. One of the more interesting ways in which these progressive groups and gay rights groups acted in this case was that they tried to tar the Christian Right legal team, like Alliance Defense Fund, with some of the most extreme supporters of OK Greena. Some of the groups that most people, whether on left or right, would think are just beyond the pale, such as the Westboro Baptist Church. And the Westboro Baptist Church did actually put up this kind of a tombstone saying Sweden is doomed. They have a picture of OK Greena there. They basically said, you know, that if you're going to put a pastor in jail for preaching the Bible, then all is lost in a country like Sweden. Sweden is doomed. In any event, I don't think this had very much impact. They don't have much impact at all. But the gay rights groups and the progressive groups, in an effort to undermine the Christian right and their appeal in Sweden, tried to suggest that the ADF was closely linked, and Green himself was closely linked with this beyond the pale group, Westboro Baptist Church. So my point here is that these groups are fighting tooth and nail, dirty tactics on both sides, really, very sophisticated legal tactics also on both sides. And in Sweden itself, this, as I already mentioned, became a huge issue, with people protesting in the streets when the Supreme Court actually reached its decision, and on both sides of this issue as well. And in the end, what happened was that the Swedish Supreme Court did overturn his conviction. They decided that the hate speech law on sexual orientation grounds was constitutional in Sweden, but that European Union law, basically kind of a foreign law to Sweden, would meant that there was a violation of his freedom of expression rights. And those freedom of expression rights would have to trump the hate speech conviction. So he ended up not serving time. However, the hate speech law remains on the books. So they kind of divided the baby halfway, if you will. But for the Christian right, this was a huge victory. OK Greena, in the quote at the top there, expresses his gratitude and basically says, if it weren't for the American groups, ADF, coming in from Scottsdale to support him, he would have ended up in jail. And the people from ADF saw this case as a major victory for them, not just in Sweden, but all over the world. So for me, this was a really interesting example of how the Christian right is trying to stop what it considers bad law overseas as a way then of maybe preventing that type of law from coming to the United States or to other countries. And I found with more research that this case was in fact brought back to the United States by the Christian right. In 2004, the Republican Party, in fundraising letters for George Bush, actually mentioned the Green case and had it as kind of a horror story for what might happen if the LGBT agenda promoted by the Democratic Party were to come into place. And I think it was relatively successful. Can't say this was the main reason Bush was reelected, but it undoubtedly didn't hurt. The other even more interesting way in which that now five-year-old case was brought back into the United States was in 2008, when California had a proposition on the ballot, Proposition 8, which would have overturned the California Supreme Court decision a few years earlier, which had ended their same-sex marriage provision. So there was a battle between the Christian right, which was saying yes on Proposition 8, and the LGBT groups saying vote no on Proposition 8. Basically, this was a battle over whether same-sex marriage should become legal again in California. Now, what was particularly interesting is that Swedish case and OK Greena himself became a big part of the battle in California. So what had happened years before in Sweden, at least in part because of what US lawyers had done, was then brought back into the United States. And across California, there was what was called a religious dissident tour, in which Green, who, although he couldn't speak any English, went around to Christian conservatives saying, this is what happened to me. I was prosecuted sentenced to 1 month in jail for what I said from the Bible on a pulpit in Sweden. And this could happen to you too if you don't vote the right way. And so this was also simulcast across California. And he became cause celeb, but also a indicator of what could happen if this Proposition 8 battle wasn't won by the Christian right. And again, there's no way to be sure how important this was in the Proposition 8 campaign, but ultimately the Christian right won in this campaign, even though that's the year, by the way, that Obama was elected. So there was kind of a progressive wave, if you will, but in California, a progressive state, the Proposition 8 battle was actually won by the Christian right. So I think this played some role there and shows, again, how this kind of case, even in a country far away from the United States, can become so important even in our own politics. So, quote from Jim Garlow, who's a relatively mainstream guy. He was invited by Obama, I think, to his first inauguration, and may have even been gave a talk there, I think. Anyway, he says, "Green is a symbol of what's ahead. When homosexual marriage is protected, the government must declare anything in opposition hate speech, and presumably then end up with people in jail if they engage in hate speech." So just to conclude this particular section of the talk, what we see here is a case of the Christian right in the United States going kind of against its instincts, which are to focus only on U.S. law, but when they see a case overseas that might potentially appear threatening to their views on same-sex marriage or gay rights or any number of other issues worldwide, when they see a case taking place overseas, they will send their top people or other types of support overseas, not only to help in that particular place, but also because they see how that kind of a case can then help them back here. Same thing goes in a more sort of proactive way for how they try to implant what I call good law for them overseas. And the case study here is Romania. As I mentioned earlier, Romania, at least from the sort of the gay rights group perspective, is one of the most regressive countries in Europe. It's a country dominated by the Romanian Orthodox Church, and LGBT rights have historically been sort of off the radar screen. It's a country, it's kind of the polar opposite of Sweden, if you will. So that's, by the way, from a methodological standpoint, as a political scientist, that's why I decided to look at Romania and Sweden, because one was very progressive and one was very backward, if you will, on these issues. Now, despite the fact that Romania has been hostile to same-sex marriage and LGBT rights more generally, under the Romanian constitutional code that they had in place from the communist era, marriage was defined in a kind of vague way. It was defined as the union of two spouses. And I think at the time that the communists came up with this definition of marriage, no one was thinking about the possibility of same-sex marriage, so they used kind of vague terminology. What happened in the early 2000s was that the European Union, as many countries began to promote gay rights and particularly same-sex marriage, saw that Romania potentially already had a law in place that would allow same-sex marriage because it was defined so broadly, so vaguely. It was defined as the union of two spouses. That could be both of them being men, potentially. So the European Union, in the early 2000s, decided, let's try to promote same-sex marriage in Romania because the law is already there. So from the perspective of the Romanian Orthodox Church and other Christian conservatives in Romania, this was an appalling prospect. They could not stomach the idea that their laws already permitted same-sex marriage. I'm not sure if this is mine or yours. I'll put it over there. I think it's yours. Yeah, we have similar buttons, but the buttons go flying. Anyway, the Christian conservatives and Orthodox Church in Romania were very afraid that same-sex marriage would come to them just by virtue of this kind of holdover of the communist era, which no one had thought to change. So as the European Union and various LGBT rights groups in Europe moved into Romania and tried to take advantage of this law, the Christian right forms new organizations in Romania and reaches out overseas for support to try to avoid this dire prospect for them. In 2007, they form a group called the Alliance of Romanian Families. And the man who forms it, there is on the right, is a man named Peter Costea. He's actually a Romanian-American. He, at the time, I interviewed him again by phone. He was based in Dallas and was, I think, a regular corporate attorney. But on the side, he worked with the Alliance Defense Fund. And he decided to found this organization back in Romania. He had dual citizenship, and he went to Romania frequently. And he, as a Christian conservative, felt that we need to organize in Romania with the support of the Americans, who know how to do this very well. We need to organize against the prospect of same-sex marriage being brought into Romania. So they reach out, they network, just like in the other case, and in the case of the United Nations. They network with a whole range of organizations in Romania, including the Romanian Orthodox Church. Oh, and by the way, I should mention that Costea was actually a Baptist, and his father had been a Baptist. He'd been jailed by the communists when they lived in Romania in the 60s and 70s. But he reached out to the Romanian Orthodox Church, as well as a whole range of both American and international Christian rights groups to try to bring activism on this issue to Romania. On the other side, the LGBT rights groups, as this kind of battle heats up, reach out to Human Rights Watch, which is a mainstream human rights organization, and to the Council of Europe, which is an organization of all of the states of the European Union, as well as a number of others who are not in the European Union, that works on legal and constitutional issues, and has generally had a very progressive viewpoint on gay rights. So kind of the battle lines were drawn in Romania in the mid-2000s on this issue of what should be done with the existing code in Romania, which, at least on the face of it, permitted same-sex marriage. Well, the main strategy that the Alliance for Romanian Families came up with was, let's import American-style Defense of Marriage Act provisions. The Defense of Marriage Act was put in the early 90s in the U.S. At the national level. President Clinton signed it at the time, and it basically made same-sex marriage illegal. The Christian right groups used petitions that they sent to the entire nation, because the petitions were the basis on which they could potentially have a referendum on changing the code. They had protests. Some of them were very violent anti-gay protests against the LGBT rights groups, especially on Pride days that were attempted in Bucharest. Others were nonviolent, but it got at times very, very nasty. The World Congress of Families, another major group I mentioned last time, became involved, sent a petition itself to the Romanian parliament to try to prevent same-sex marriage from being put into place. There were global media appeals among the Christian right media in places like LifeSite News and Focus on the Family, which has a big media arm as well. Similarly, as I mentioned, on the left, the LGBT rights groups had significant lobbying that they did at the Council of Europe and the European Union, which potentially could have a large effect in Romania. Romania is a large country, but also one of the poorer countries, and it gets a lot of subsidies from the European Union. So there were efforts to put economic pressure on the country's parliament and president to prevent the same-sex marriage law from being actually implemented there. And I think, again, most interestingly, at least from my perspective, was the way in which legal aid was provided. In particular, the ways in which the basically language of the Defense of Marriage Act in the United States was copied and pasted into Romanian petitions and ultimately into Romanian law itself. Both sides in this were using not only American-style law, but also international human rights law to make their claims on either side of whether same-sex marriage should be legal. Human Rights Watch in particular, which is a sort of political and legal organization here in the United States, actually did file some legal-style briefs with the Romanian parliament saying, you know, you should already have same-sex marriage based on the law you currently have. And the human rights groups also looked to international law, in particular the Yogyakarta principles, which also promoted the idea that human rights include within them already LGBT rights and even same-sex marriage. So what was the outcome? Well, in 2009, after the petitions and after a referendum that the Romanian people overwhelmingly supported, the Romanian parliament put into place a new, essentially, Defense of Marriage Act based on the U.S. law. It changed Article 258 of their code defining marriages from the union of two spouses to the union of a man and a woman. You can see there Article 259 changes that. And it goes even further and provides no recognition for foreign same-sex marriages, or even civil unions. So they were trying to really protect against any incursion of same-sex marriage, even from people who maybe moved to Romania after getting married in Sweden or in Holland or someplace like that. Question?
It
means prior to the Obergefell ruling here in the United States, for instance, civil unions were a way of giving most of the rights of marriage to a couple, a same-sex couple, without actually calling it a marriage. So that's essentially what we mean. At this point in the U.S., I don't think it even matters or exists anymore since same-sex marriage has been approved. But other countries, at least at that time, about 10 years ago, and the United States, had this differentiation between a civil union and a same-sex marriage. It's more like a partnership, if you will. A common marriage, common law marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a little different. I mean, that's where I think that it was like if you're married to, or if you're cohabiting for 7 or 10 years or something like that. I don't know the exact timeline. But at that point, it would have only been a man and a woman, for sure. But anyway, to just conclude this, what happened in this case was that U.S. lawyers, Peter Costea in particular, who again, by the way, I had a very long interview with, he's very pleasant to talk to by phone, gave me lots of information. He and the Alliance Defense Fund were able to put into place in Romania a law that they hoped would not only prevent same-sex marriage there, but also act as proof that other European countries felt that marriage should only be between a man and a woman, and that they could use this precedent in Romania to argue back here in the United States that there was a division of opinion in Europe over whether same-sex marriage should be permitted. they thought this would be good strategy to keep the same-sex marriage tide at bay, keep it, slow it down here in the United States, and to fight in particular the human rights groups and LGBT rights groups here in the United States who often claimed that the United States was behind Western countries, especially Western European countries, because we didn't have as many rights for LGBT people or same-sex marriage. So to my mind, this was a very clever, maybe sort of underhanded strategy, if you want to look at it that way, in which the Christian right tried to proactively go abroad, bring U.S. law, basically a copy of the Defense of Marriage Act, to another country, and then be able to say, look, this country, Romania, bans same-sex marriage here in the United States. We should too. Anyway, I'll conclude with that and open it up to questions in the last 15 minutes or so, and shoot away. Yes? You guys are it. Well, I mean, as I mentioned last week, one of the more interesting things I have found is that although I'd say the heart of the pro-gay rights and same-sex marriage constituency is not necessarily all that religious, they're more looking at this as sort of a basic human right and a social necessity for their populations. In carrying out the battle over same-sex marriage against the religious right, they're trying as well to use religious texts, the Bible included, to argue that actually it is part of biblical teaching to have same-sex marriage. I mentioned last week a foundation, the Arcus Foundation, which has put a lot of money into this effort to promote a religiously based basis for same-sex marriage. And they have, you know, gone through the Bible, find passages, not just the general passages, but also more specific ones that they can use in promoting the idea that it's not, religion is not against us. Religion is actually for us if we interpret it in the right way. So I guess that's the clearest way I guess I could put it. But I mean, obviously there are some very progressive confessions, progressive faiths that are quite active in promoting LGBT rights around the world. Unitarians, I think, would be one in particular. Yes?
Well, as you know, there are battles within mainline denominations.
Yeah, that's true, too.
And we spent, I don't know, was it a year, but many months doing what you just described. And today, a same-sex couple is going to join the church.
Mm-hmm.
So we landed as a church on the side that you're describing.
Right.
But it's not like there's not a war inside mainline denominations, right?
Right. That is for sure. And I talked about this with someone last week also, but is it the Episcopal Church that has actually divided? And many in the Episcopal Church are now under the African church because they're more
Presbyterian Church.
Okay. And did some parts of the Presbyterian Church go under an African leadership? No.
One in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis. I thought they were very progressive. But African churches tend to be very conservative on these issues. And it may be the Episcopals. I'm not 100% sure. But one group did split and basically say, we're going to go with the sort of international leadership that's very, very conservative on this issue. So, yeah.
I think the Episcopal Church really split. Anglican being the conservative.
Yeah. I mean, these battles are ones that happen, you know, I guess, within individual churches, and they go right up to the international level, and they happen in many parts of the world as well. I would say, just as a kind of footnote here, I think generally African churches are very conservative, more or less across the board, at least as far as I know, on these issues. So that's, for the Christian right, a very fertile place for their activism and for kind of gaining their own support, at least moral support, from parts of the world where they see these traditional and natural families being upheld very, very strongly, not only by churches, but also by governments.
Do you have any idea why that's true in the African-American church?
In the African-American church? Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not really sure about that. I'll just say one thing. In this, I have another book that I've put out since that Global Right Wing book, but in this book, I actually do talk about the ways in which the African-American constituency within the Democratic Party has been split to some extent by issues of LGBT rights and the question of same-sex marriage. Because although on many social issues African-Americans are quite progressive, many progressive, socially progressive African-Americans are not comfortable with same-sex marriage in particular. And in this book, I look at the way in which the Republican Party has tried to split that constituency, try to use gay rights as what I call a wedge issue to drive apart African-American communities, especially in the South, from the mainstream Democratic Party. I call that using rights as a weapon. And I see this in a lot of other cases. This book also talks a little bit about Africa and fights over LGBT rights there as well. So, if anyone's interested. Yes?
I think religious people who focus on the Bible as a source to decide which side they're going to be on, you know, on the right or the left, we have a problem in because people who focus on things in the Bible with regard to marriage maybe are sort of cherry-picking, because they could have also
absolutely
taken things in the Bible about slavery. If I read the Bible, it seems to, you know, condone slavery. Well, why don't they pick that, too? You can take some of it or take all of it. It's just a problem.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's how, you know, both on left and right, this is used. It's basically a tactic. I'm not sure how convincing it is, but once one side starts to use one type of argument, the other often feels compelled to fight back using the same type of argument instead of just starting a new area to argue over. So as I mentioned last time, the fight on same-sex marriage has a scientific aspect to it. It's got a moral, religious aspect to it, and both sides fight on those grounds, tooth and nail. So. It's a toughie in the U.S.
Because it's not, I don't know that there's any objective standard for it. I mean, really, you could say it's like pornography, and I don't want to see it, but, you know.
Yeah, as Americans with the First Amendment, which is frankly a very unusual provision in any constitution around the world, we are generally quite comfortable with statements that in other countries will land you in jail. I mean, this hate speech laws are very common in Western Europe. It's not as common to have one that's based on sexual orientation, but that's starting to spread. And, you know, things like denying the Holocaust. You know, people on the fringes can do that here without facing any threat. Whereas in Europe, people end up in jail for 2 years or more in France for doing that sort of thing, and other countries as well. So, yeah, hate speech is a toughie, for sure.
But it just really scares me, because what's the next step? Are they going to take it to the point that it's illegal and you get jailed? And what's the next step after that? Are they going to take gay people out and shoot them?
They do in Africa.
I mean, really?
They do in Africa, and they did in the British Navy in the 1800s.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the laws in Uganda and Nigeria and some other major countries in Africa, promoted in part by the Christian right, are extremely harsh with regard to homosexual activity. And as far as I know, there has not been any government-sponsored execution, but there certainly have been hate crimes that have resulted in the deaths of gay people in countries like Uganda and Nigeria. And it's really terrible, no question about it. This is, I think, these most extreme types of reactions to LGBT activism are generally opposed by the Christian right, at least the mainstream groups that I have looked at. As I mentioned last time, the term that's often used, especially by the Catholic Church, is love the sinner but hate the sin. And so that, I guess, is a way of basically saying, people should not be punished. They should be helped to overcome, what they see as unnatural activities. It's the line between that and actual punishment, even long jail sentences and possibly even death sentences, is relatively thin, especially in some of the countries in Africa where these laws are actually on the books.
Why did you pick this issue to focus on? What was it that caught your attention about this?
That's a good question.
You could have focused on a lot of it.
Oh yeah, yeah. What did get me into this? Well, I've done research for many years on NGOs and activism around the world, and that's been a big issue in political science for many people. And almost all of my colleagues and myself focused on human rights groups, environmental groups, social justice groups, various progressive groups that we believe in and really like. And I wrote a book called The Marketing of Rebellion about how certain types of causes in countries like Nigeria and Mexico and many other parts of the world get a lot of international media attention, but other very similar causes are just left by the wayside. We don't ever hear about them here in the United States. And what I was looking at there was how human rights groups and environmental groups and social justice groups on the left get involved in these issues. And I guess one day I learned that I think it was actually the NRA first. I focused on the National Rifle Association. I learned that they were going to Brazil to promote gun rights in Brazil against the human rights groups that were trying to reduce the carnage as a result of huge numbers of guns on the streets in Brazil. And that just struck me as really bad on one hand, and also just really interesting, because I had never heard that the National Rifle Association would be going overseas. And on that basis, I spent some time in Brazil and interviewed people at the UN, where the NRA was also active, and decided this is really worth writing a book about, not just about the NRA, but other aspects of conservatism and how it's internationalized. And so then I got into the Christian right. That was the second area I looked into. And I actually was doing all this research before sort of the rise of the populist and nationalist right, which has happened all over Europe, and you could say here as well, with the rise of Trump. I'm still doing some research on that area as well, because it's not just individual nationalist politicians, but there's actually kind of a nationalist international. They get together and they work together. Steve Bannon has been one of the key people bringing together these nationalist parties and social movements across Europe. So I got into it sort of inadvertently. It's not been a really long-term interest, but I've now been doing research on this for at least 10 years. And there's lots more. It keeps actually expanding. It's a growth industry, for better or for worse.
Okay, I'm a lawyer, so this question that I'm going to ask you kind of comes out of that background.
Sure.
Anthropologists are finding that sexuality is like a whole spectrum. We're running out of letters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our Constitution was drafted over 200 years ago by people that never even thought of us. So do you think we painted ourselves into a corner, or do you think the Constitution is flexible enough and foreseeing enough so that it still is a relevant guide to how to deal with sexuality as it now is understood by those who have studied it seriously.
Right. Well, that's a very tough question. You could probably ask that about all manner of other issues too, not just sexuality with regard to the Constitution. I guess I have a fair amount of faith in our Constitution, in part because it is short and vague, and I'm not sure how much true foresight the Founding Fathers had, but they certainly wrote it in such a way, I think, that you could breathe lots of different meanings and interpretations into that document. Now, obviously, there are people who think we need to go back to only what is, you know, stated directly in the document or that was thought at that time, originalists. I think we're going to continue to see a battle between originalists and those who believe in an evolving constitution. And that, to me, I think, although we can potentially think about an amendment to the Constitution to talk about issues of sexuality, I would say that we can also more or less stick with the text and just have it interpreted and still be able to take account of that kind of diversity. I mean, the fact that the Obergefell decision happened just a few years ago and same-sex marriage is legal across the country now as a result of that, I think is indicative of how, you know, you can read that Constitution broadly. Now, obviously, that decision, I think, is potentially under threat from new justices who might be appointed by President Trump or some other Republican. But at the same time, as I mentioned last time, I think there's the Christian right has, in a lot of ways, lost the kind of cultural battle over sexuality. I think most people, majorities in the United States, even probably majorities of Republicans, support LGBT rights at minimum. Maybe not same-sex marriage as such, although they might be okay with a civil union sort of approach. So, in short, I guess I think the U.S. Constitution is—it's a great document, and it is flexible enough, especially with the possibility of amendments to deal with these issues.
One more question: the same question could substitute the Bible for the Constitution.
Oh, okay. Is it a flexible enough document? If you have people in liberal faiths like your own reading it and subscribing to it and also approving sexual identities and same-sex marriage and at the same time the Christian right doing so, yeah, I'd say yeah, it is. So again, as you I think said earlier, it's a long document, way longer than the Constitution, and has all sorts of things one can cherry pick if one wants or just take the essence of it.
Can I have a third question?
As long as no one else is, sure.
Terms of being foresightful and being...
John, say that again with your...
Okay, Jesus was not one of the founding fathers of our country, so he didn't have any input into the Constitution, but he is in the Bible. So add that to the question.
Do you mind if I punt on that one? Not being a Christian? I'm not going to... I don't think I want to comment on that one. I don't feel qualified, really. Although I teach at a Catholic school, but still, it's... I don't think that's a good enough qualification to answer that. No problem.
Fair enough.
Another front that's opening up is what is taught in schools, grade schools,
absolutely,
about the whole issues that we're talking about now. And I haven't followed it closely, but I think Illinois passed something in the legislature requiring some sort of instruction on homosexual rights.
Mm-hmm. This is a huge battleground, and actually, it's funny you should mention that because I was at a conference last Friday, Thursday and Friday, in Washington, where we have a research group that's actually looking at these kind of issues on sexuality and religion, specifically in schools, and in the U.S. as well as Western Europe. And yeah, these are huge battles in which the Christian right is heavily involved. One of the most important aspects of it is that the Christian right here and in many European countries believes that the schools have become, you know, bastions of secularism, teaching an ideology that will pollute the minds of their children. And so they fight that ideology, fight the sort of legislation you're talking about, and when they lose, they pull their kids out of school. So homeschooling has become a major cause of the Christian right. There's a group called the Homeschooling Legal Defense Association, a group of lawyers who go around the country and around the world now fighting to allow homeschooling because they claim that the schools are, you know, as I say, you know, the place that homosexuality is taught to people, as well as other bad things are taught. So this is an area I'm definitely focusing new research on right now, and maybe in a few years I can come back and tell you about some of these homeschooling battles that are going on. But they're very hot. And I, one other thing, I think I actually started last week by mentioning, in some countries in Western Europe, like Germany, homeschooling is illegal, and people have been jailed or their children have been taken from them because they're being homeschooled on the basis I just mentioned. So Christian right is highly supportive of those people. They use them as kind of cause celebs, just like Oka Greena, say this is what happens when it goes so far, and this is the kind of threat we have to fight, not only in the U.S., but around the world.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.